So every single one of us is telling a story about Jesus. Now, and that applies, like if you're sitting here this morning and you don't subscribe to Jesus as Lord over your life, you're still telling a story about Jesus. That's what we believe the Bible says. And that story is told certainly when we talk about Jesus or when we come to church or when we tell someone what we believe. We're always telling a story about Jesus. Because remember a couple of weeks ago, we said our story isn't the main story. Our story is a part of Jesus' story, not the other way around. So the story that gets told is really spoken in the way that we respond to frustrations or the way that we treat people who can't do anything for us. We tell the story of Jesus and what we do with our money and how we speak to people who disagree with us by how we handle disappointments, successes, conflicts, and inconveniences. It's certainly told in milestone moments, but I think it becomes a little more obvious as the little moments begin to stack up in our relationships over time. Have you ever been impressed by somebody before, only to find out later that they're not who they sold themselves to be? I think we've all had that, haven't we? And I think we've all done that, right? I mean, no, I'm not using you. I'm debating on whether to use my wife as an example right now. But she just gave me permission. You all heard it. All right. But it was funny because when we were dating, apparently, I think I've told you this before, but apparently I came off as a very clean man. Y'all seen my office?
Yeah.
So, like, yeah, sometimes we sell ourselves in those moments trying to get something that we really want that we don't. And it's when you get close to people that you see the song, the story of their lives. It's when you get close to people that you get to see how they treat the people that they love, right? Like, it's been said that you can tell, in that dating example, you can tell a lot about a man by how he treats his mother. I still kiss my mom, right? So everybody's like, that's weird. I know. No, it's not. But like, that's, you get to see the story of someone's life, not in what they project, but by how they handle the moments that matter. Does that make sense? And so I think it becomes more obvious as these little things stack up in relationships over time. That has implications for us as people, as Christ followers, as a church. Because we can, thinking church-wide right now, we can advertise ourselves as a real church. We can advertise ourselves as an authentic church. We can advertise ourselves as a friendly church. But I've seen, I think I can say this because this church doesn't exist anymore. There was a church one time that had on their front sign at their church that said, friendliest church in Lapeer. No, it wasn't on our building. And I knew for a fact, like I had people that I knew outside of my church that went to that church and was like, they be lying. Like, I've been there. They don't like people there, you know, and so we can try and sell something. We can try and sell Jesus in our marketing influenced world, right? We can try and push that out there. But if it's not actually true, then what story have we told? Does that make sense this morning? So it raises this question that becomes a little bit uncomfortable. If someone knew nothing about Jesus except for what they could see in my life, what would they think he's like? Sit with that for a second. In the last few weeks, we've been talking about a simple way of describing the kind of church that Jesus is calling us to become. Mending hearts, making disciples, and now today, magnifying Christ. These things are not supposed to be catchy. They're not supposed to be a marketing slogan. They're meant to be guideposts, useful to us as a church, to help us be on the same page, to say in another way how it is that we are going to love God and love others that's maybe a little bit more tangible. Because it's easy for anyone to say, well, yeah, I love people, and then they don't act like they love people. But Jesus, we see Jesus mending what's broken in us, which means that we've got to look at what's broken in us, right? Like, we talk about and confess sin and evil and wickedness, and we keep nudging ourselves and one another closer to Jesus even in the midst of that. That's not commonplace in the church sometimes. Because when we talk about sin, what's the fear? We talk about our sin, what's the fear? Is that we're going to lose all the relationships around us, right? That the church is going to kick us out. Donna was telling me today, she got a letter from the church and she thought, oh, they're kicking me out. Right? And that was perfect. I'm so glad you told me that story this morning. But like, we think that, do we not? The scripture, it talks about the fact that the community of Jesus should be a place where we can unload what is in us, and it shouldn't surprise us. Jesus mends what's broken. We get closer to Him in order to mend what's broken. And as we stay close to Jesus, He forms us into disciples. He forms us into disciples. We are humbled and we are challenged. We are trained in kingdom life and see both God and people differently than when we did before we got close and learned to walk in His ways. And church, as Jesus mends us and forms us, more and more of His character then is going to become visible through our lives. I heard someone say one time that a lion doesn't need to say it's a lion. Right? I don't need a lion to walk up to me and shake my hand and be like, yo, I'm a lion. But we know people like that, don't we? That was one of the most impressive things about Terry that I learned post-mortem, I guess is the way to say that, is that the guy knew Muhammad Ali. He had dinner with Muhammad Ali. He sat in my house probably 20, maybe 30 times over the last year. Never once in a group setting where he could have scored brownie points with some of us. Never once was like, so guys, I had dinner with Muhammad Ali. Ain't that pretty cool? Like, that's a name drop, isn't it? But he didn't. A lion doesn't need to say it's a lion. Similarly, there's a really authentic thing that happens when someone is mended and formed by Jesus. You don't need to ask, you just know. Do you know a Christian like that? You don't have to wonder, do they follow Jesus? They don't have to tell you. They don't have to have a bumper sticker on their car, right? Or carry their Bible around or wear the Jesus shirt or any of the things that we do because we live in a marketing world. And I'm not saying those things are wrong. It's one way we can start conversations, for sure. But do we just advertise Jesus? Or do we depend on Jesus? So whether that's a confidence or a hope or a calm or a wisdom or just looking in on their life, you can just tell. You can just tell. And that is what I mean to communicate when I say that we magnify Christ. We don't need to manufacture excitement or create emotional moments or build something impressive that attracts people. Because the Lion of Judah does not need us to make him look impressive. He already is. Magnifying Jesus doesn't mean making Jesus bigger or more interesting than he already is. I don't know that we even need to convince people that Jesus is worth noticing. We can live so closely to him that over time people begin to see his strength. They begin to see his mercy, see his holiness, see his courage, and see his love moving through us. So I don't think the question is so much, when we think about magnifying something, we think of a magnifying glass, right? We think of making something bigger so that we can see all the detail. And oftentimes that's what we do in Bible study. We examine the scriptures and we find all these really cool facts and things. We almost We dig into the text and we put a magnifying glass on it. We sit with it and we do all that. That's that option. But how many of you got to see the bright old moon this week, right? We had the lunar eclipse and then we had the massive moon. We all saw the moon out at the bonfire the other night and it was gorgeous. You could see different spots on the moon. It was so bright. But what happens if you take a telescope to it? Whew, it comes closer, right? What I'm talking about today is not so much the magnifying glass and digging into the nitty-gritty details. I'm talking about the telescope. How do we live in such a way that we bring Jesus closer to this world? That we live so closely to Him that over time people begin to see His attributes. It's not how do we make Jesus look impressive, it's how do we step aside so that people don't see us and don't see what we do, but that they see Jesus and what He can do. To answer that question, Jesus gives really a surprisingly simple answer to that in John chapter 15. I want to read this to you. You're going to recognize it, I think, if you've been a part of the church for any length of time. But Jesus says this. He says, "I am the true vine, and my Father is the gardener. Every branch in me that does not produce fruit, He removes. And He prunes every branch that produces fruit so that it will produce more fruit." You know, a grapevine, you have to trim back like 90% of the vine every year, right? He prunes it so that it can expand and produce more fruit. "You are already clean because of the word I have spoken to you." Keep that in your mind. "Remain in me and I in you. Just as a branch is unable to produce fruit by itself unless it remains on the vine, neither can you unless you remain in me. I am the vine, you are the branches. The one who remains in me and I in him produces much fruit, because you can do nothing without me. If anyone does not remain in me, he is thrown aside like a branch and he withers. They gather them, throw them into the fire, and they are burned. But if you remain in me and my words remain in you, ask whatever you want and it will be done for you. My Father is glorified by this, that you produce much fruit and prove to be my disciples." Now, this eight verses, there's so much that we could talk about in here, but I want to just zone in on the principal teaching. The goal of God, the gardener, is a harvest or fruit. Right? It makes no sense to be a gardener if you're not going to gain a return from it, right? Because that's a lot of work. Keeping a garden is a lot of work. And like having those tomatoes last week to just munch on and still this week, although they're getting a little soft, right? They're delicious. But it takes work to get those. You can't just go out and be like, throw some things around, right? And see what happens. You've got to tend to them all season long. Jesus compares that fruit with proof of being disciples of Jesus, right? That's in the last name, or the last verse. My Father is glorified by this. So how do we glorify God? That you produce much fruit and prove to be my disciples. Stick with me here, especially you longtime Christians, because I need you to listen, because it's very easy to start mixing biblical metaphors here, illustrations. Fruit in this teaching is not more Christians. Like when I hear about a harvest, I think of the verse that says, the harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few. And that's a charge to go out and to take the gospel to the world. But this is not, that's a separate illustration, separate metaphor. Fruit in this teaching is not more Christians. Jesus would go on to say this in verses 9 through 12. He says, as the Father has loved me, I have also loved you. Remain in my love. If you keep my commands and you remain in my love, just as I have kept my Father's commands and remain in his love, I have told you these things so that my joy may be in you and your joy may be complete. This is my command. Love one another as I have loved you. What is mentioned here that proves one is a disciple of Jesus? He's explaining the illustration in these verses here. What we see is love for God, right? Remain, love God as I have loved God and God has loved me. It gets kind of like really twisty in your mind sometimes, right? It kind of like a drain. But we have the love for God. We have the obedience to God. We see a result of greater joy in our lives. And we see a love for one another. And the way that that happens is that we remain in Jesus. This is so simple, it gets confusing. So I want to explain it like this. I can't wake up one day and think, I need to love God more. So I'm just going to love God more. How does that work? Right? Nobody has to tell me to love cookies. I don't need to convince myself that I love cookies. But broccoli, there are days, right? There are days. I know a day is coming and that has passed for many of you, but there are probably going to be days where I need to figure out how to love my daughter because she's being a pistol, right? Parents, am I speaking the truth? You always love them, but you gotta like, oh, you know? Like that parental guttural growl of you're just getting under my skin, right? I know I ain't seen nothing yet, but I'm trying to gear up for it and get all the wisdom I can for when that day comes, all right? But we could think that I need to love the people at church more. But it's hard to love the people at church sometimes, isn't it? And we can't just wake up and say, oh, let's turn up the dial on that this morning. It doesn't work like that. At least it doesn't for me. If it does for you, we need to have a conversation. And I can't just decide that I'm going to obey God more today than I did yesterday. Right? Like, it doesn't work like that. There is something in us that is broken and constantly draws us away from God. And so we may come to church on Sunday and be like, all right, this week I'm going to get it. That hit me. The message hit me. The song hit me. The people loved me. It was great. I'm going to go out and I'm going to obey God more this week. And Tuesday, you're like, you know, I've already messed it up, so why even try? And you go through enough of those cycles and you get beat down and you just kind of fade away, right? You can't just turn the dial up to 11. You can't just say, I'm going to have an extra measure of joy from this day forward. It doesn't work like that for most people. So by calling us branches and saying that we can do nothing apart from Him, Jesus is being very honest with us. He's saying that you and I don't have the ability to will those kinds of things inside of us into existence. Am I clear this morning so far? You can't increase your own love for things. You can't increase your own joy for things. You can't increase your own obedience. You don't have that ability, is what Jesus is telling us here. And at the very same time, He's telling us that that's not the expectation. For some of you, that might be a big old relief, while at the same time being very confusing, because for some of you, Christians have told you over and over and over and over and over again that it's your responsibility to figure out how to love God more, to obey better, to look joyful, to love people better. And I want to tell you that there is a reason why you can't figure that out. Because Jesus is telling us right here, it's not your job. That is not the responsibility that I've given to you. You cannot manufacture the fruit. You can't force love, joy, holiness, obedience into existence by sheer effort. What Jesus is asking us to do, He says, remain in me. Remain in me. Stay put. Stay where you are. Stay close. Come to me, all of you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, and you will find even more rest. It goes back to that all the time. You can't... He's saying, stay connected to the vine. Stay close to Jesus. Let his words live in you. Keep walking in his commands, however imperfect that might be. Keep receiving his love. And as the life of the vine flows through the branches, fruit grows. Remaining in Jesus then looks a whole lot different. His words in us look so very different. It doesn't sound like an angry parent pointing out what you just did wrong. Because that's the image I get from a lot of people that talk about him. That's the image I've had for some time. It sounds like, as the Father has loved me, I have also loved you. That sounds like grace, doesn't it? As the Father has loved me, when you remain in me, I have loved you. You're welcome here with all of your dirt and your grime. You're welcome here with all of the evil that resides in you. You're welcome here in all of your frustration. You're welcome in the presence of Jesus because there is grace here. And if you graft onto the vine, life is going to be flowing through it. Things are going to change. You're going to see the fruit of what it looks like to be a disciple. Remaining in Jesus then sounds like rest. It sounds like dependence. And that word, a lot of us don't like that word. To depend on someone else for things. I mean, how many of you have said just in the last month, well, I don't like to ask for help? Right? Yeah. I don't like to be dependent on anyone else. I want to be able to prove that I can do it myself. That might be the issue that you're facing with Jesus then. Because the very things that have become hallmarks of Christianity, of the faith, of being a good Christian, of loving God and loving others, is that you, independent of Jesus, can figure it out. And the overwhelming evidence just by looking at Christians is, no, you can't, unless you're on the vine. So we stop trying to be the source. We let his words remain in us. Yes, that is the instruction. We're not getting away from obedience, but we let his instruction remain in us, train us how to think. That's the disciple aspect of this, right? But also the care that took him to the cross for you. Like even in this, when he says, remain in me, as the Father has loved me, I love you, right? Like those statements, we pass over those things. Because we're looking for the checklist. We're looking for the summary, not the struggle. Where this begins is we receive from Jesus what we can't create in ourselves. In that way, we step aside and let Jesus be magnified. Because when love and obedience, when patience and joy and mercy and grace begin showing up in our lives, we won't be able to say, look at what I produced. Right? Like when you become more patient, it's not because you willed patience into existence, right? Because the joke, at least in our church, has been, don't pray for patience. Because God's going to give you an opportunity to grow, right? Like that. But when you see yourself becoming more patient and you look back over the last few years of your life, you go, oh yeah, God has been doing a work on me, right? But it takes years. Like Christine and I, this past summer, man, it sounds weird. You guys realize September is like a couple days away. I'm so sad to say this past summer. But we've got a lot of wild berry bushes around our house. You know, and Thank God, because Elise is a berry girl. She wants the berries, not the apples and bananas that are cheaper, right? And so God provided this year, and they would go out like almost every day and pick the berries off the thing, and Elise would hold the cup, and Christine would put them in there, and by the time they got inside, they were all gone, right? So like it was really great, but it got me thinking, like watching them be able to go out and do that, like I've always kind of wanted some, like a fruit tree or something at our house, and so started looking into it, and you know what? It takes 3-4 gosh darn years for that thing to start producing fruit. Same thing with the vines. So, kind of a two-pronged or two-sided coin. Why is it that we expect the second that somebody accepts Jesus into their lives and said they're going to follow Jesus, like, why do we expect fruit to appear tomorrow? And why do we expect that of ourselves? This is not a process that where we can manufacture the fruit, right? When we see these things begin growing in our lives, we kind of get excited and we're like, hurry up, hurry up, hurry up. But you can't look at an apple on a tree and be like, get bigger, get bigger, get bigger, get bigger, right? You can't do that. And the same thing, like the branch doesn't get credit for the life flowing through it. I don't look at an apple on a tree and be like, that's a sturdy branch, you know? I don't give credit to the branch, I give credit to the tree, right? And same thing with the branches on the vine. We don't look at the singular branches on that vine and be like, you're a good branch, right? We look at the vine and be like, look at the harvest that this was able to produce. It's one thing. It points back to the vine. And being dependent like that, sometimes the gardener, you know, sometimes he has to come along and cut away things that convince us that we can do this on our own. Everybody say, ouch. That's called pruning. It's one thing to say, Jesus, I need you to produce fruit in me. It gets harder when we say, Jesus, you can decide what fruit, what life looks like while you do it. Because remaining on the vine eventually leads to surrender in where Jesus takes you. And that's where this gets uncomfortable, because so far, it sounds like magnifying Christ is a lot of Christians singing, Kumbaya, my Lord. But what if remaining in Jesus costs something or makes me look strange? It's hard to stay faithful in criticism or when other Christians seem to be disengaged or even apathetic. What if Jesus leads me somewhere I'm afraid to go? What does it look like to magnify Jesus in that situation? And Paul wrestled with this. In Philippians 1, verse 20, Paul says, my eager expectation and hope is that I will not be ashamed about anything, but that now, as always, with all courage, Christ will be highly honored in my body, whether by life or by death. For me to live is Christ, and to die is gain. Now, keep in mind that Paul is in prison when he's writing this. What happens in the next few days for him is not up to him. It's a very real possibility that he could be executed. So that changes what that means, right? It's not like we're all sitting around at the Ludwig's farm being like, yeah, we love Jesus, to live is Christ, to die is gain, and we get to go home and sleep on our beds and wake up the next morning with Saturday kind of open and whatever we want to do, right? That's not the life Paul is living. He's in jail. And somebody else is deciding whether or not he gets more days. I can't imagine that he wants to be there, but this is where God has him. And Paul names shame, and he contrasts it with courage. That tells us that there's a very real pressure here to shrink back in those moments, to protect ourselves, to soften what he has claimed through his life. I would say that that's probably pretty common if the threat of public death is on your mind. So he's fighting back, saying that he hopes and even expects that if that time comes, He will not walk back what he has so boldly claimed in an effort to protect himself. When he says, "For me to live is Christ and to die is gain," here's what he means for us to understand. Whatever happens to me, let Jesus look great through it. There is a discussion to be had then in our modern times when it comes to dying as a result of our faith, but I think it's far more profitable in our time together this morning to think about the situations where we do feel ashamed or afraid to live out faithfully, simply because that's going to be more common. Paul says that it's his hope and expectation that Christ will be highly honored in his body. That is the driving thought. That's the driving thought. What does it look like for Jesus to be honored in Paul's body? What does it look? What would make Jesus look great in that moment? How can I magnify Christ to the people looking on? Now, for us, Jesus is often a part of our lives, but Jesus is not always central. We tend to protect ourselves or promote ourselves or please ourselves. And whenever that becomes more important than honoring Jesus, we start blocking his view. So what does it look like for Christ to be honored in your body? Not outside of your body, not on a t-shirt, but what does it look like for Christ to be honored in your body? So when you have a chance to protect yourself, what does it look like to honor Christ? When you have the chance to promote yourself, what does it look like to honor Christ? And when you have the chance to please yourself, what does it look like to honor Christ? It's a super different way of thinking because most of us walk into any room and think, what do I want to see happen? Right? You had expectations coming here this morning, right? What do I want to see happen? I hope the message is good. I hope I leave feeling good. Right, that's what most people want out of church these days, right? I hope I leave feeling good. I hope I learn something that maybe I didn't know before. I hope we get to lunch on time, right? Not going to happen the way it's going this morning. I'm kidding. I hope I get to see so-and-so, right? The godmother is here. She's lots of people that she's wanted to see coming into church. She wasn't thinking about worshiping Jesus. She was thinking about all you, right? But Paul is asking, whatever happens, how can Christ be honored in me? And I don't think there's a cookie-cutter way of answering this question. That's why I'm asking more questions than I am giving answers for this particular text. Because the faithful response might look different depending on the person or the relationship or the moment even. Sometimes honoring Christ means speaking, and sometimes it means shutting your mouth. True. Sometimes it means drawing close to someone, and other times it looks like creating a little distance. Sometimes honoring Christ means giving, and other times it means saying no. But the driving question, the principle, remains the same. What will magnify Christ here? When you walk into a room, what does honoring Jesus look like? When you open your mouth, when you park your car, when you work, when you have some time to relax, when you're out on a date, when you're on social media, what does it look like for me to step aside and for Christ to be honored? And really, Paul's answer is surrender. We walk into a room, we ask, what can I get out of this? And what we're doing is trying to control the outcome. With this baseline idea of this needs to be worth my time. I don't want to waste my time on this. How many of you have said that before? Right? What if what you perceive as a waste of time is actually a huge encouragement to someone else that you might not know about, or you find out about it later on? Paul's answer is surrender, and he's saying, I don't have to control the outcome of what happens. I don't have to protect my image. I don't have to make sure that this turns out the way I want to. He says, whether by life or death, whether this goes the way I want it to or not, let Christ be magnified in me. Because when things don't go your way, do people see Jesus? Like, answer that for yourself. When things don't go your way, do people see Jesus honored in your body? Probably not, right? That's how we step aside. We surrender the outcome so that Jesus can remain at the center. So, in order for Jesus to be at the center, we have to take whatever is currently in the center out. In order for Jesus to become more visible, some other things have to become less visible. Peter explains what a life magnifying Christ looks like. In 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 9 through 12, he says, "But you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for his possession, so that you may proclaim the praises of the one who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. Once you were not a people, but now you are God's people. You had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. Dear friends, I urge you as strangers and exiles to abstain from sinful desires that wage war against the soul. Conduct yourselves honorably among the Gentiles so that when they slander you as evildoers, they will observe your good works and will glorify God on the day he visits." Now, there's a temptation to read this and jump into doing instead of remaining like we just talked about. And sure, Peter's reminding us to behave ourselves, right? Like, that's part of this. We can't neglect that. But verse 9 is huge. God calls us a holy nation. You, Christian, God's calling you a holy nation collectively. A royal priesthood, a people for his possession. So that what? So what's the goal? So that we might proclaim God's praises. What are we praising God for? Jesse, would you mind backing up one slide? So that you may proclaim the praises of the one who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. Out of darkness and into his marvelous light, that we might sing his praises because he's rescued us. That's the motivation. That's the drive behind the behave. And those commands are what remaining in Jesus looks like when it becomes visible through us. When we start producing the fruit that Jesus talked about, remaining has been happening. We're hearing Jesus' words for the care, not the condemnation. And we've begun training ourselves to see that situations God places us in are actual opportunities to honor Jesus instead of honoring ourselves. They're not serving as a test, they're serving as a revelation. Church, I think maybe you haven't thought about it like this before, but sin is a revelation to you about the darkness that you're walking in. Without the darkness, you wouldn't appreciate the light, right? Could you imagine what life would look like if we could see no light? Here's the thing. As the fruit grows, what begins to lose its rightful place in us? Peter says sinful desires. Now that's important. Not just sin, but the desire to sin. And specifically, ones that wage war against the soul. That's strong language, right? Why did he add that on there? Because I don't think that it was just for effect. I think he wants us to think about it. That desire is going to shine through you no matter how much you talk about Jesus or try to live for Jesus. If your heart is bothered by something else that you really want, it's eventually going to become clear to anyone who's close to you. And that is going to obscure the picture of Jesus in your life. Peter isn't just talking about surface level habits. He goes underneath behavior. When he talks about sinful desires that wage war against your soul, he's not talking about cussing. Right? Everybody's like, oh, thank goodness. I'm not guilty this morning. Yeah, okay. We're confessing our sin this morning. This is good. All right, yeah. No, he's going underneath of that, folks. He's talking about our appetites. He's talking about what we crave. He's talking about our anger. He's talking about our ego. He's talking about whatever bitterness we've been hanging on to, greed, or even the need for someone else's approval. Because when you mix those things in with the vision of Jesus, you cloud that vision of Jesus. Right, again, going back to the moon, it was so great when we were out at the bonfire, but driving home, you know what happened? Those pesky clouds got in the way. You could see the outline of the moon, like sort of, you could see the cloud like glowing around it, but you're like, get out of the way, right? We cloud the vision of Jesus when we allow these sinful desires that wage war for our soul to live. And you tell a confusing story about Jesus. Maybe you haven't thought about it like that before. Because when you say Jesus forgives all your sin, and then you hang on to the sin of another person who has harmed you or offended you, you're not telling the story of Jesus. And when you talk about how generous God has been to you, but you're a miser, and you're scraping and clawing for all the things, and you're greedy, you're not telling the story of our great and generous God. And when you choose to live in darkness, and you want to claim that Jesus has called you out of darkness and into marvelous light, you're not telling a clear story of who Jesus is. I think in this instance, actions speak louder than words. And how you live reflects what you believe. I'm not saying try harder. Is not what I'm saying today. Is you got to be perfect in order to tell people about Jesus. That's not what I'm saying. Please do not hear that. We got to go back to Jesus. We got to get closer to Jesus so that the life can flow through us, so that the heart of stone can be removed and the heart of flesh can be transplanted in, so that His Spirit will cause us to walk in His commands. We'll want to. Peter then says, here's what becomes more visible. He says, conduct yourselves honorably among those who don't believe, which is another way of saying that people outside of Jesus should see something unusual in you. Not weird. Right? We don't need to go be weird Christians. The world doesn't need more of that. Right? Amen? All right. I'm just making sure you're awake. We're almost done. Don't worry. But different. Different. So for instance, you show mercy instead of retaliation. Because you go out there, it's a dog-eat-dog world out there, is it not? You're not going to get any mercy from anyone else. You're not going to get mercy at your job from your boss if they're not a Christian. You're not going to get mercy from the stock market. You're not going to get mercy from the president. You're not going to get mercy from anyone else. So when you go out there and you live with mercy, that first time, it's not like everybody's going to be like, I have seen the light, right? They're not going to say that. In fact, they're going to look at you and be like, you're an idiot, right? You're going to be generous instead of grasping for all you can get. You're going to show integrity when dishonesty would be easier. I think this is the biggest plague of our culture today. There is no more integrity out there. Everything is a lie, right? You hear something from someone and you look up in the sky and you're like, poison? And the vaccines are poison and the food is poison. Can't go to Taco Bell anymore because you might explode, right? Like, where do you go? You are kind toward people who aren't useful to you. You're steady and maybe even at peace when circumstances are chaotic. Right? That is so comforting. I've had moments of that with different people in our church through the years. There have been a couple of times, and I've shared it with you, where I thought this church was just going to disintegrate. And I was panicking because, like, I'm the quarterback, right? Like, everybody blames the quarterback when things are going wrong. And yeah, I mean, at that stage of my life, I was probably more concerned about what pleased me, what protected me, right? And can't say I wouldn't fall into that trap again today. But there were people around me who were faithful, who were steady. They said, it looks bad now, but God is at work. Trust Him. Be still. Pray. Right? Trust what you know about the Scriptures. Let Jesus' words remain in you. Because regardless of whether, at least in my situation, whether this church thrives or fails, that doesn't change anything about the gospel. And that steadiness taught me some things about how I approach other people now. How I sit in the hospital room with folks when people are near death. It changes how we sit with sin when people are confessing things. It changes how we operate and come alongside of some people and not others. The goal isn't to get people to think, wow, they're impressive. That's not the goal. The goal is there must be something real about the God they belong to. People don't say that when we're in Bible thumping mode, right? And they don't say that when we're trying to preach at them. People say that when life gets hard and in those little moments, and it's in those little moments that seem insignificant at the time. That's why remaining in Christ and doing the heart work to keep Jesus central in our hearts is so important. Because we get comfortable around the people that we're around all the time. And often just expect them to take the worst parts of us. When the hard moments come and stretch our limits, that's when the heart really speaks, doesn't it? Whatever is central in our lives comes straight to the surface because out of the heart, the mouth speaks. And so when you remove the brain from that equation, we say you take the filter out, right? And you just say everything that you're feeling in that moment. It's a dark place, isn't it? That's real dark. And then we follow it up with, well, I didn't mean it when I said it. Really? Like, have you ever analyzed that in yourself when you're making that claim? Then why did you say it? Whatever is central comes straight to the surface, and it's a revelation that Jesus still isn't quite central in ourselves. So Peter says the goal isn't to rack up brownie points with God. He's not saying abstain from sin so that you look good and get your heaven card punched. It's that even people who misunderstand us criticize us or accuse us might eventually see the fruit of a life changed by Jesus and then glorify God. That's the whole thing. Pop to the next slide real quick for me, Jesse. I want you to see this. So that, everybody say, so that. We're almost done. When they slander you as evildoers, they will observe your good works and will glorify God on the day that he visits. Magnifying Christ. The building of little moments. Not building a reputation, but in relationships where we simultaneously love God and love the people that God has created. When we do this, they will see our good works. And for a while, they're going to slander you. For a while, they're going to say, that's not wise. For a while, they're going to say all sorts of things that are going to try and discourage you. But what Peter says is that there is a future in this world where if you live with Christ at the center, if you remain in Jesus, if you keep making those decisions to keep him central in your life and you keep removing whatever darkness appears and is revealed to you, there is going to come a day when people are going to look at you and say, I saw God through you. And they will be in eternity because you chose to remain in Jesus. Not because you went to the mission field. Not because you stood on a stage like this and preached. Not because you gained a title in the church. Not because you led a Bible study. But how you treated your wife or your husband. How you treated your kids. How you handled other people in their worst moments in life. How you handled yourself in the worst moments of life. Showing that Jesus is central to you no matter what comes your way. Whether it's life, it's Christ. If it's death, then I gain. Right? And on that last day when God visits, every knee will bow, every tongue will confess that Jesus is Lord, not because of you, because of him. But if they're not on the side of, oh, I wish I would have listened, it's going to be because the church was the hands and the feet of Christ. And they took the vision of Jesus out into the marketplace. They took the vision of Jesus into their workplace. They took the vision of Jesus. They lived with Jesus at the center, dependent, surrendered. And somebody said, wow, that's different. Let me ask a few questions. And it started them down that path. Because they saw Jesus in you. This is the whole thing. So how do we step aside so people don't just see us and what we can do, but Jesus and what he can do? We remain in him because we are not the source. We surrender the outcome because our comfort and our reputation are not the goal. And we resist whatever keeps trying to take the center so that the life Jesus is producing in us becomes easier to see. That's what we're after. Not impressive Christians, not a church that knows how to market Jesus, not a people who've learned how to look religious. We want lives that make Jesus difficult to miss. Because the Lion of Judah doesn't need us to convince anybody that he's a lion. He just needs room to be seen. So remain in him, surrender to him, let him change what's at the center of you. And then let your life tell the truth about Jesus. We magnify Christ when his life becomes visible through ours. Church, the vision is Jesus.